Hello, and welcome to the first episode of Lab Water Stories Unfiltered. I'm Monica Jock, your host, a scientist, and a scientific writer for the life science business of Merck, KGaA, Darmstadt, Germany. I've been writing about the MillyQ Lab Water Solutions portfolio for the last 7 years, which makes me a bit of a specialist on the topic, or rather a specialist in knowing which actual specialist to turn to when I have questions. And this brings me to the subject of this podcast, where I and my go-to gurus take a closer look at the unsung hero of the laboratory, water. We'll discuss why this seemingly ordinary reagent holds the key to your reliable results and a smooth-running lab. We'll list golden rules to avoid contamination and save time, journey to exciting places you may not suspect do science, and therefore need water, and learn how to make lab water greener. Let's start by giving lab water the attention it deserves by first recognizing that not all water is created equal. So, what are we talking about? In this episode, we're starting with the basics, Lab Water 101. In the lab, much time and effort are spent designing and planning experiments, selecting reagents, and so on. But how often do scientists pause to ensure they're working with the correct water quality for their analyses? To help us dip our toes into this topic of lab water, there is no better person than my guest for today, Daniel Darbaret. Daniel is a senior scientific director who has been working with the MillyQ Lab Water Solutions portfolio for over 30 years. Daniel, my guru, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, Monica, and thanks a lot for this invitation.
Well, thank you for accepting it because we need you. So, Daniel, can you describe your job in a nutshell for our listeners?
Yes, of course. My pleasure, Monica. So after different positions in our life science R&D departments since 1990, and you are right, you know, surfing on high purity waters makes time fly by, I now have the privilege of acting as R&D scientific and regulatory advisor for our colleagues.
And for myself. So today you're going to advise not just myself, but us and our listeners. Can you start by telling us why purified water is in fact so critical to scientists in the lab?
Yes, I will answer that question, but in just a moment, you know, Monica, because I would like to start by clarifying that although the term pure or clean water is used to describe drinking water, this pure water is not pure enough for scientists, you know. Tap water is great for drinking because it contains some elements and minerals that we need to stay healthy, like magnesium and calcium. But for scientists, these elements are considered contaminants to their experiments. In the labs, scientists need to make sure that there are no interfering factors in their experiments.
Okay, I want to quickly dive into these interfering factors. What are the interfering factors that we find in water that are problematic in labs?
Yeah, you know, overall, there are four main classes of contaminants. And in addition to the ions you have in tap water, which is the first class, the three other classes of contaminants you can find are the organics, the microorganisms, such as virus and bacteria, and the particulates. And by the way, an interesting area of research nowadays is the topic of contaminating microplastics found in our tap water. And even more, you can find much more microplastics in drinking bottled water, by the way. And those microplastics actually fall under two categories, you know, particulates and organics.
And so how do we get rid of them? How do scientists manage to remove all these contaminants from their water when they need to remove them?
And unfortunately, there is no single magic bullet, you know. You need to have multiple technologies that must be combined to remove all four categories of water contaminants. The very great first step is the reverse osmosis, or RO. It allows to remove many contaminants, but then you need more specialized technologies to remove the remaining contaminants. You know, ions are removed by ionization resins or electrodeionizations. Mm-hmm. Organics are removed by activated carbon and UV photooxidations. And UV lamps help also to control bacterial growth. And last but not least, small particles are removed by micro or ultrafiltrations, like for the microplastic we just mentioned before.
And so with microplastics being an issue, what about the plastics and tubing in the water systems themselves?
Yeah, this is an important point you raised here. And our R&D colleagues, they take great care in choosing and testing our materials to prevent leachables from any material from contaminating the final product water.
And so, Daniel, I started this episode by saying that not all water is created equal. Of course, what I meant to say or should have said is that not all water is purified to the same extent. So let's deep dive into this topic of water quality. Can you guide us through the different lab water quality grades that scientists should be aware of?
Yeah, so let's start with tap water, you know, as most labs do. If tap water is purified by reverse osmosis only, this is called RO water or tap-free. And RO water is much purer than tap water, removing 90% or 90% of contaminants found in tap water.
90% of contaminants sounds pretty good to me. Scientists still aren't happy with this?
Yeah, this sounds great, but you know, it's still not pure enough for scientific analysis. After RO, water often undergoes a deionization or electrodeionization step to achieve DI or EDI water, or commonly called type 2 water. And as the name deionized implies, this water contains even fewer ions compared to RO water. And if type 2 water is purified or polished even further, we arrive at pop quiz, Monica. Up to you to find what
it is. Okay, I'm listening. You did type 3, you did type 2. I'm going to give it my best guess and say type 1 water.
Yeah, correct. Well done. Type 1 ding, ding, or ultra pure water, you know, it's a which is extremely pure for 4 contaminant types. And in particular, you know, removing nearly all ions gives the water a very low conductivity or high resistivity. And the resistivity value of ultra pure water is 18.2 megohm, which is in contrast to tap water that is highly conductive and ion rich.
That's right. It's why you never swim when there's a lightning storm, because of the conductivity of the water. So, okay, I have a pop quiz for you now, Daniel. Does this mean, Stay with me now, does this mean that I can swim during a lightning storm if my pool was filled with ultra pure water?
This is a funny question, you know. It changes from the scientist questions, you know. Actually, I've never tried, but I don't think I want to, you know. And I'm not sure your skin would like that, you know. Ultra pure water may not be so good for your skin.
Okay, and that's a lot of ultra pure water. Okay, I tried. Okay, but theoretically, I might not get electrocuted if I didn't care about my skin. All right, so now we're at the crux that all our scientific listeners are waiting for. We've talked about 3 types of water quality and tap water, if you want to include that one too. So we'll say 4 types. So which water quality do scientists need for which types of analyses?
You know, in a nutshell, to make things simple, we will say that RO type-free water is recommended for non-critical lab applications, such as glassware rinsing, heating baths, or autoclaves. DI or type 2 water is used for general lab use, for example, to prepare buffers, reagents, and culture media, and also to feed some other equipment, you know, some analyzers and some dishwashers in the lab. And finally, ultra pure or type 1 water is recommended for sensitive applications, you know, advanced analytical techniques such as HPLC, UPLC, LC-MS. It could also be used for molecular biology applications, PCR sequencing, and also used in the buffers and culture media for mammalian cell culture. Just some examples of critical applications in the lab.
So my theoretical swimming pool is not a critical application, so we'll leave it off the list. So I wish I knew this quick checklist. Years ago, many moons ago, when I was doing my thesis in a lab, and to this day, I still have no idea what water quality I was working with, to be honest. We autoclaved the water coming from a carboy. I don't know. It was academic. So I'm curious, if I could go back and you were there to whisper in my ear and tell me how I can do my experiments better, I'll tell you that I was running PCRs, purifying proteins on SDS page gels. What water quality should have I been using in this perfect academic world that didn't exist for me?
Yeah. You know, Monica would say that in your case, you know, of course, you will need ultra pure water type 1. This is the basis, using all the technology we mentioned before. But as you are working with PCR technology, you are also working on a protein analysis. It is very important that you eliminate all remaining nucleases or proteases that could be present at a trace level in your ultra pure water. So I would have strongly recommended to use ultrafiltration device at the point of dispense, such as our biopack that can be fitted on our MediQ equipment.
So should have been having a nice type 1 water system with a polisher, an ultrafiltration polisher to get rid of the nuclease. Okay.
Exactly.
If I can only go back and do it all over again. Okay. So in general, tell our listeners who might not be familiar or maybe who have only seen one way of doing it within their lab experience, how in general do labs go about obtaining their purified water supply?
Yeah, previously, you know, the standard was that labs use distillations or purchase highly purified bottled water. But those solutions were problematic and inconvenient because of variability in quality. Distillation does not remove all contaminants. For example, you have the volatile organics that may contaminate your water. And it's quite inefficient in terms of energy and water usage. And also, once you have this ultra-pure water in a bottle, once you open your bottle, the ultra-pure water will absorb contaminants from the atmosphere. So an open bottle of ultra-pure water doesn't stay ultra-pure.
Ah, just to say, my swimming pool would not have stayed ultra-pure, so maybe I would have gotten electrocuted. So you bring up a good point. So back in the day, you mentioned that it was the previous standard to use distillation and even buy bottled ultra-pure water. What is the case nowadays for labs? How are they getting their purified water?
Yeah, you're right. Now labs usually obtain the water from a water purification system that can purify from tap to any quality we mentioned above, according to their needs.
Okay, thank you for that. And so we're getting to the end, and I have one last question for you. We work every day with the MillIQ Lab Water Solutions portfolio. Can you tell me and our listeners, where does the name MillIQ originate from?
Yes. So you see, the name MillIQ originates from Millipore, the company who developed the systems and was acquired in 2010 by Merck KGaA Darmstadt, Germany. And in fact, the term MillIQ used to specifically be used to refer to ultra-pure water quality. But today, MillIQ is a brand name of any system from a MillIQ portfolio. So MillIQ systems now can make not only ultra-pure water, but all the water grades we just discussed before.
Ah, I got you. Thank you for that little lesson in history, bringing us right to today. We're at the end. Do you have any final thoughts to leave me and our listeners with, Daniel?
Yeah, just a closing quote. You know, I just want to leave with my favorite water quote from one personal lab water guru, you know, an old colleague, Bernard. Without water, there is no life. Without labs, there is no science. And without lab water, there is no life science.
I like that. Thank you. Thank you for your words of wisdom. Thank you for being my guest and for setting the foundation of this podcast series. I really appreciate you walking through this topic that's so critical for scientists to understand, but is often overlooked, you know, which water quality they should be using when. I think it's a really good foundation that we don't necessarily see in textbooks or here in the classroom.
This was my pleasure, Monica. Thank you.
Are ghost peaks haunting your chromatograms? Perhaps unstable baselines are throwing you off tilt. Did the band in your gel pull a vanishing act? Or you can't reproduce another lab's results? Maybe it all comes down to troubled waters. In this segment, we'll troubleshoot some of these frustrating scientific predicaments with the help of our lab water experts.
Today, I'm with Estelle Richet, an applications expert based in France who has been working closely with the MillIQ Lab Water Solutions portfolio for nearly 20 years. Estelle, you've been helping scientists troubleshoot their science and their lab water quality for quite a while now. Can you tell me, what is one of the most frequent questions you receive from scientists?
That's not an easy question. I mean, I get so many different topics, but I do receive one particular question over and over. And I think that's a really interesting scientific topic.
Okay, come on. The suspense is killing me. Please share it.
Actually, scientists often call because they are saying they're having difficulty measuring the pH of their ultra-pure water, or sometimes they complain that they're getting really strange values for the pH of their ultra-pure water, and they're wondering what's happening.
Okay, I'm sorry, but I've been in a lab and measuring pH is a pretty natural thing to do. So what's wrong with measuring pH here?
Yes. So, of course, many scientists want to measure the pH of their solutions, and it can absolutely make sense to measure the pH of your ultra-pure water. But in reality, this is really, really difficult to do because the first reason is that ultra-pure water basically does not contain any ions. So the electrode of your pH meter or the chemicals that are present in your pH paper won't work well. And so they will give you really strange values, and the pH will seem to fluctuate, and it will be very difficult to figure out, you know, what's the real value there. And in some cases, actually, putting the electrode of your pH meter into ultra-pure water can damage it a bit. So really, that's one concern. And then the second point is that ultra-pure water actually absorbs the carbon dioxide from the air. And what happens is then that CO2 becomes carbonic acid. So that will impact the pH of your water. And so slowly it will drift towards an acidic pH, usually around 5.6. So really, if you wanted to measure the pH of your ultra-pure water in the correct way, you would need, first of all, a special kind of pH electrode that works with this type of extremely pure water. You would need a specific pH calibration solution and even a flow-through cell so that you can isolate your ultra-pure water from the air. So this is really, really complex, and I'm sure none of us wants to do this. And the thing is, we need to find a better way.
Right. Not only does no one want to do this, they're probably not equipped to do it. And so the point is that people are trying to measure the pH of the ultra-pure water as an indicator of its purity, but this is in fact leading them down a rabbit hole. So what in fact should we be looking at to know if our ultra-pure water is good enough to use?
Yeah, indeed. We can have other ways to know that water is extremely pure. And one way, if you're considering pH, meaning you're considering ions in your water, one way is to just look at the resistivity of your ultra-pure water. Because if the resistivity displayed is 18.2 megohm centimeter, that means your water is extremely pure, contains basically no ions, and therefore it also means that its pH is, you know, the theoretical pH of extremely pure water, it's 7. So if your resistivity is 18.2, you know that the pH of your water is 7. You don't even need to measure it. So if you're using an ultra-pure water system, then all you need to do is just look at the built-in resistivity monitor and you know, nothing to do.
Great. Just make sure theory matches practice. That sounds easier. Skip the pH. And if a scientist still needs to control their pH, what should they be doing?
So the fact is that ultra-pure water actually has very poor buffering capacity. And so its pH can vary very quickly as soon as even a tiny amount of contamination enters the water. So it will shift pH by several units simply by being in contact with maybe a beaker, being in contact with an electrode to measure the pH and all this. So really, if you want to control your pH, if you have to prepare a solution where you need pH to be 7, for example, it's a much better idea to prepare a buffer than to use really straight ultra-pure water. So that would be my recommendation really for this.
Great. Thank you, Estelle, for sharing this common troubled waters issue with us. Perhaps we have some listeners right now who are currently struggling with measuring pH of their ultra-pure water, and now we know why. Plus, we now have a better approach to check the quality of ultra-pure water, sticking to the resistivity. And for this, I thank you. To our listeners, if you have a troubled waters story you want to share with us, feel free to leave your experience in the comments. And with that, we've reached the end of our first episode. I encourage any scientists out there to investigate their lab water quality. And if you're not a scientist, but you know one, do them a favor and share this episode with them. Please also let us know your thoughts on this podcast in the comments, give us a rating, and share with whomever you think might be interested. See you again in 2 weeks. Bye, everyone.
life science business of Merck KGaA Darmstadt, Germany, operates as MilliporeSigma in the US and Canada.